Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lunatics Radio Hour. I'm Abby Brinker. I'm here with Alan Kudan.
Hello.
And today, we have the long-anticipated episode for you, The History of Mermaids.
I'm pretty excited for this one.
How excited?
Six.
That's pretty good. Six out of five,
that's right.
That's great. I mean, listen, mermaids are big mer people, big on my list. I'm super excited. I kind of have avoided this topic for a while because I'm like, well, how does it relate to horror? But listen, you guys, it does, and we're going to get into it.
Oh, does it? Mermaids wrote the book on horror.
That's right.
Scary things.
So we have quite a lot to talk about today. Everything from the tons of different iterations of mermaids and mer creatures across so many cultures, but also my favorite part, which is some of the sightings, like real life sightings of mermaids. And of course, we're going to have a Lunatics Library episode that goes with this, with really cool mermaid stories for you. So without further ado, let's dive right in. Today's sources: Mermaids, The Myths, Legends, and Lore by Sky Alexander. And thank you so much to Al Goodsell for sending me that book because it was super helpful. Britannica and Wikipedia, Mythology and Fiction Explained video on YouTube, mermaidsofearth.com, and How Stuff Works article, an article from folklorethursday.com, The Legends of History on YouTube, another book called The Mythical Creatures Bible by Brenda Rosen. And once again, thank you to Al Goodsell for your tips and tricks on this one.
I want to quote my own book for this. I mean, I didn't write it.
Okay.
But I read it.
What book?
So this is supposed to be the number one book on murderous mermaids.
It's fiction or nonfiction?
Oh, it's a complete work of fiction.
Okay.
But I mean, also mermaids, right?
Sure.
So, you know, I feel like you can quote fiction.
Oh, yeah.
As dogma. Because sure. Why not?
No, I'm with you.
So this book was Into the Drowning Deep.
Okay.
By Myra Grant.
And you liked it?
Loved it.
I can't wait to hear more about that when we get to the infamous pop culture section. But let us start, as always, with the history. Tales of mermaids and folklore of aquatic humanoids spans most countries and cultures. Mermaids were worshipped in seaside temples by ancient societies and have penetrated the hearts of millennials in the form of Disney's The Little Mermaid, myself certainly included.
I did not know that this movie was so recent. I mean, recent.
1989, right?
Yeah. I thought this was like Snow White, which just came out forever ago.
No, I mean, the music in it alone certainly screams...
Screams modernity.
Doesn't it?
Me? I don't know. I've only seen the movie once.
What?
And that was, I don't know, like 1996.
I've seen the movie like once a day between the years of like 1994 and 1998. But yeah, we'll certainly get into that.
I've only seen it once, and that was like at a friend's house, at like on in the background when they're like, you got to check out this great movie.
Yeah, you have to. That's what middle school friends are for.
And then we ended up playing with Legos.
Now you have memories of this day?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's transformative.
What did you have for lunch yesterday? So one of the earliest mermaid stories is that of Atagartis, which we're going to get into a bit. But she was a priestess from Assyria who jumped into the ocean to wash away shame caused by an unintended pregnancy, only to emerge as a powerful mermaid goddess. We also have the goddess of love, Aphrodite, who was created from seashell foam and, as we know, came to land via a huge shell. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. So we're going to get into lots of different mermaids and mer creatures across different mythologies today. But let's start with the basics: symbolism of water in folklore and the occult. For example, water is a huge factor in tarot in the form of the suit of cups. And in astrology, water signs are famous for their emotional depth. And I'm talking about the history of symbology here, not whether or not we personally believe in astrology or tarot of those things, right? But regardless, we can all acknowledge that there's a reason why water has penetrated the occult in certain ways, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, water in general is the foundation of society.
Exactly.
Every civilization on Earth at one point started close to water.
Exactly.
Or in the water.
Right.
Our ancient ancestors swam as we were, you know, little sentient tadpoles.
Mm-hmm. So water fertilizes our crops and hydrates our bodies, just like you said, giving us what we need to survive. It's nurturing and necessary for life. Because of these factors, it's easy to understand why many, but not all, of our mythical water creatures are feminine. This doesn't necessarily mean female in gender, but are feminine in energy.
Also, most myths of sea creatures originate from sailors.
Yes, exactly.
And sailors, you know, it's a lonely life.
It is.
And so if you're out on the deck of a ship and you just see something, a humanoid glistening through the waves.
Maybe a seal.
You're going to project like
a hot babe.
Your hot babe, as opposed to be like, oh, that's Harry Frank.
Harry Frank. Exactly. So here's some interesting fun facts on the etymology. The word mer comes from Old English word mer, which means sea. In French, mer means sea and mer means mother. Sky Alexander, who's the author of the book that I read, calls out how this very clearly shows us that language has identified the sea as the mother of Earth, or mankind, so to speak.
Sure.
Today we're going to explore different forms of merfolk from many different regions of the world, some of which are not necessarily our own ancestry, but we wanted to talk about them because they represent like the true origins of this mythical creature.
Right. And if we don't talk about them, how are we possibly going to appropriate them?
Or how are we possibly going to appreciate them, right? And learn about them.
That's what I said.
In a respectful way. It's also interesting to call out now that some of these are local folklore and legends, right? And some are mythology. So in many cultures, water creatures and aquatic humanoids are actually seen as like gods and goddesses.
Sure.
Divine beings, not just sea creatures, right?
Right.
So there's, so that's just interesting to call out the distinction between. It's not just like all sailors seeing seals that they think are hot babes. It's also some societies and cultures worshipped the deities of the sea in the form of mermaids and mermen.
Right. I mean, we've all been seduced by a sexy seal sometime.
At least once a year.
But to envision the sea, which is, you know, from standing on the coast, looks endless.
Right.
When you're out in the ocean, it also looks endless.
Right.
And you can't see the bottom. It's unknowable. It's inhospitable.
Mm-hmm.
Any sentient being that can live and thrive in this environment has to have some kind of higher power. Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. And again, like you said, because water represents everything we need, it also makes sense that there would be throughout history mythological creatures, right, or gods and goddesses that heralded the ocean, that defended the ocean, that provided the ocean.
Speaking of sentient sea creatures.
Oh, sure.
You didn't comment on my shirt.
I literally just noticed it and I was like, oh, after this, I'll have to comment. Alan is wearing his dolphin shirt.
Not just any dolphin.
It looks
please.
Like a Lisa Frank dolphin baseball
tee. How dare you?
That's what it looks like to me.
This is the box art for Echo the Dolphin, the Sega Genesis phenomenal video game.
We'll have to take a photo of it for listeners.
Sure. So this shirt was a gift by a big friend of the pod, the Metal Beast.
The Metal Beast himself. Make sure you follow the Metal Beast on Twitch to watch him play through all sorts of awesome old school video games.
You won't see him playing Echo the Dolphin simply because that was Sega. But you'll see him play all sorts of weird stuff that you would never, ever be exposed to otherwise.
There you go. One quick point before we jump into this. When we say mermaid, we're probably thinking about a female or femme figure, right? With the tail of a fish and the upper body of a human.
I'm not.
But different regions across the world have different versions of what a mermaid physically looks like. So I want you to erase all of that from your mind and come into the history of this with open mind, open heart.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
But I have stuff prepared.
Okay, well, you can remember the relevant stuff, but everything else I want you to let go of. There have been, Alan, so many mermaid sightings throughout history.
Name one.
I'll name many, my friend.
I've got a couple.
You've seen mermaids?
No. But yes, I've seen one.
Where?
What do you mean? Why are you laughing at me? I've seen a mermaid.
Where? What? In a photo?
No.
With your eyes?
Yes.
Someone in a costume?
Yes.
Okay.
But I was a child.
Uh-huh.
At the Great Escape.
Okay.
And they have a high dive show.
She high dived with a mermaid tail on?
Mm-mm. It's a high dive show, but the tank is glass.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, multiple tiers of, like, the dive. You know how these giant ladder dives go, right?
Sure.
And so you know, the bottom tier has like three diving boards and they just do synchronized dives and stuff. And like as people dive from the bottom of the tank, which you can't see because you just see the side, which is glass.
Yeah.
And you could, you know, there's like a secret entrance or something to the pool because a mermaid would just like come up and just like hold the numbers being like rank the dives and then just swim back down.
Oh, that's cute.
It was really cute.
Yeah.
And then the announcer would like banter about, hey, get that mermaid out of this tank. And then she would come up with a sign that says, kiss my bass. And as a, I don't know, 10-year-old,
yes.
I thought that was the funniest joke in the history of comedy.
It's pretty good. It's a pretty good joke.
I could not figure it out because she never came up for air.
Mm. She's good at holding her breath.
For like an hour?
Yeah.
Wow.
As expected, most sightings or claimed sightings are from sailors or people living right in coastal regions.
Mm-hmm.
These sightings have perpetuated mermaid figures in sailor lore dating back to the Middle Ages. The most enduring tale is that mermaids sought to seduce sailors and drag them below the surface to their watery kingdoms. Some believed that mermaids even controlled the weather, causing storms and even wrecking ships in order to get hold of the sailors on board.
Sea witches.
Sea witches. This myth was solidified by the medieval church, as mermaids became a symbol of lust, vanity, and immoral women.
Manity?
Did I say manity?
Yeah, what the hell's manity?
Vanity.
Vanity. This is a perfect segue to the one historical mermaid sighting that I wrote down.
Okay, because I've got a lot of historical mermaid sightings that I wrote down.
Well, we're going to jump ahead
okay,
to 1493.
Okay, hang on. We're going to get there, but why don't we talk about it in a minute? I've got a few to talk about first.
Okay.
So colonizers often reported encountering merfolk on their travels. Christopher Columbus, Henry Hudson, John Smith. In 1608, in Russian waters...
Whoa. 1608?
I'm starting with the 1600s. We're circling back to the 14... Listen, I'm just reading the outline, man, okay?
You already discussed Christopher Columbus.
Okay.
My sighting is from Christopher Columbus.
I know, I have it. Okay. In 1608, in Russian waters, Hudson claimed to see a mermaid that he described as having fair skin, long black hair, large breasts, and a porpoise tail.
Being a bully.
In 1614, after he met Pocahontas, John Smith spotted a mermaid in the West Indies who he claimed had long green hair, and he would have fallen in love with her if not for her fishtail. But over 100 years before that, in 1493, Alan has something to tell us about.
Screw you!
Come on, we want to hear it. What do you have to say?
Well, before I was very rudely derailed...
Mm-hmm.
I was going to tell you about Christopher Columbus and his three mermaids.
Yes, please tell me.
What do you know about this?
Columbus claimed to see three mermaids, but unsurprisingly said they weren't as pretty as he expected them to be. What do you have to say about this?
That's your whole thing?
Uh-huh.
You have nothing else.
Go ahead, jump in. Go ahead, jump in, Captain Factoid.
So he was surprised because they were much uglier than he had seen in paintings.
Right, like I just said.
However.
Yes.
The leading theory is that he did not see mermaids at all. He saw manatees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. He wasn't the brightest. He sees three manatees swimming in the ocean, and his first thought is, ah, ugly women.
Ah, women.
Though this does bring up an interesting point that I talked to about Al Goodsell.
The type of women that Christopher Columbus was into?
No, but... That I do not care about. More so that if mermaids actually were to exist, that it would be more likely, especially in like the Arctic and other cold regions off Iceland, things like that, that it would be more likely that they wouldn't be skinny, tiny women, but they would be more blubbery, right? Like seals and whales and things like that in order to keep warm in those waters. So the depiction that we have, obviously, of like beautiful petite mermaids... I think depends on the region that mermaid is in and the waters that they're swimming in.
Well, you're projecting mammalian physiology on them.
What?
So the whole idea of blubber and staying warm is exclusive only to warm-blooded mammals.
Aren't mermaids?
Well, unless they're fish. Like, there's no mammal that actually breathes water. They all breathe air. They just surface in order to do that. Mermaids, which are always depicted as breathing water, right, would have, you know, gills or some way to
process. Well, they breathe air, too.
Well, okay, so amphibious.
Yeah.
So frogs, right?
Yeah.
Well, frogs are cold-blooded. So there's no need for a frog to have blubber, if you will, because they don't produce their own body heat that they have to retain. They have the same temperature as whatever surrounding to which they are native.
That's interesting.
So, that's fish. That's why you have, like, tropical fish, you have Arctic fish,
mm-hmm.
Or you just have the deep sea fish, which it doesn't matter because all the water is the same temperature across, the bottom of the ocean floor.
Right.
Because it's approaching 0 Celsius, but it won't freeze because it's the ocean that the currents keep from freezing. So it means it doesn't drop below zero.
That's interesting. So we need to get to the bottom of whether mermaids are warm-blooded or cold-blooded to determine if they would be fat or skinny.
If they are warm-blooded,
mm-hmm.
then instead of having a blubber to or fat to, you know, as reserves, you then switch over to like the physiology of like the big cats,
mm-hmm.
where they basically just put all their stats into sleek muscle and hunting prowess and are just constantly hunting and eating.
Right.
So they just offset having fat deposits by having an insanely constant caloric intake.
Lots of animal facts there to unpack.
Well, go ahead. Well, you too can learn all these fun mermaid facts and be privy to these debates by reading Into the Drowning Deep by Myra Grant.
Perfect. We'll pick it up at our local library or small bookstore. Did you have any other sightings that you wanted to get into?
I only had the one.
Okay. Well, I have a few more to talk about. So during World War II, and this one I would say is probably one of the most famous mermaid sightings.
Okay.
In World War II, Japanese soldiers were stationed in Kei, an Indonesian island, and found what they described as a monster washed ashore. Allegedly, it was mostly human-looking, except for webbed hands and feet, and spines that ran down its head and neck. My favorite detail, though, is that their mouth looked like a carp.
A carp's mouth.
A carp is a type of fish.
Thank you. But it's just like a totally... Like, a carp, is that even a toothed fish? I think it's just like a normal fish mouth.
Right, that's why it's weird. The local villagers were familiar with these creatures.
Oh, wait, don't carp have, like, the super long mustache?
I don't know.
Like koi?
Yeah.
Did it have a mustache?
Like Magikarp.
Yeah, Magikarp.
Yeah,
I'm thinking of Magikarp.
Yeah. The local villagers were familiar with these creatures and called them Orang Ikan, which translates to man-fish.
Man-fish.
Man-fish. So that's during World War II.
Yeah.
And there's these accounts of Japanese soldiers finding these like humanoids with webbed hands and fish mouths. And there's local, and the villagers are like, oh yeah, those are the fishmen.
Hmm.
Like, yeah, duh. They wash ashore all the time. We know them.
The physical description really reminds me of Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, and I like that the physical description is not like, oh, it's a woman with a porpoise tail, because now I'm like, oh, okay, well, I wonder what this is.
Yeah.
You know? Like, let's send a team out.
I mean, it could have just been a person covered in seaweed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they've been, you know, drinking lots of sake.
Sure. In K?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, I don't know. We don't know. We don't know without a proper investigation.
Well, the big question...
Mm-hmm.
Did they note whether it was warm-blooded or cold-blooded?
No, it didn't say.
And where do these historical accounts come from?
This one came from howstuffworks.com.
Gotcha.
But I actually found this one specifically on like 3 or 4 different websites.
So this is probably a secondary source.
What I'm citing is secondary sources, but I do believe that firsthand sources exist.
Mm.
I just didn't come across them. I didn't do the work to find them.
Let's table this one for now.
Okay.
And come back, because I would love to do a deep dive.
We could do a whole episode into fishmen.
Japanese sea monsters.
Okay, putting a pin in it. In 1967, a ferry filled with tourists off the coast of Maine Island in British Columbia claimed to see a topless woman sitting on a beach eating a raw salmon. And of course, she had the body of a porpoise. Now, this one doesn't come from as much of a reputable source, but there is, they say that there is a photo that shows this, which I could not find.
Convenient.
Convenient.
Okay, if I had to guess, right?
Yeah.
They saw her sitting on a rock.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a little bit of a distance.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Woman eating raw salmon? That could have been you.
Could have been me.
Fishtail? Also could have been you. maybe she had a giant fish laying next to her, obstructing her lower half. She was just eating a whole bunch of raw fish.
Oh, that's a good theory.
What year was this?
1967. So I think I just found the photo. Do you want to see?
Yes, please.
Okay, so we're looking at it now. If you guys want to look it up at home, there's an Atlas, it's timescolonist.com, and the photo of the Active Pass mermaid taken by a ferry passenger created a stir in 1967.
Okay, so if I wanted to play a prank on somebody, why, if you are nearby a tourist area where people are going back and forth on these little pleasure cruises, right?
Yes.
You just sit on the beach, you make a little fake mermaid tail, and you bury your legs.
Mm-hmm.
They can't get close to verify, and they all have cameras, and it's 1967 before the internet. And you are just going to, you're just going to play a little fun prank on people.
Hell yeah.
It's like the guy that, he put like these fake seagull feet that were enormous,
mm-hmm.
like on the bottom of his shoes and like walked around this beach for like 50 years.
Yeah.
To the point where everyone thought that this like 500-pound bird existed and people were just trying to hunt it down.
Yeah.
You know, why not? This is just people in maritime towns having a little fun.
There's the same kind of origin story with Bigfoot, that some of the legends in a certain part of the country started with a guy who made fake prints, found them, right? And then later admitted it, but people still, you know, obviously Bigfoot is much bigger than that, but that's just like a local part of it.
Right. Now we're getting into the local sea monster.
Right.
Of Georgie.
Right.
Which we talk about every chance we get.
We, yeah.
Where... it all started as somebody with a submersible, wasn't submersible, it was remote controlled, just going around Lake George, and had this little wooden sea monster head that would pop up and scare people and then go back down. And the sightings of the Lake George sea monster became notorious.
Right.
Until he retired it, you know, came clean. He was just playing a joke. And then there's still sightings of him, not all the time, but people still claim that there are sightings of him.
Yeah.
They won't let it die.
Yeah, sounds just like how you keep bringing it up on the show. Long live Georgie. Is that
the new hashtag for the show?
Yeah, long live Georgie. In 1998, off the coast of Hawaii, a diver claimed to encounter a jumping mermaid. And as recently as 2013, Discovery helped to promote a fake documentary about the alleged new evidence of the existence of mermaids, which seemed to rile up new interest in the mythology. It was called Mermaids, the New Evidence.
That's very on the nose.
This resulted in a follow-up documentary, Mermaids, the Body Found. Both of these have been aggressively rejected by any and all scientific communities.
Hmm. That's very mean of the scientific community.
I think it's important that they reject things that are not accurate. Okay, so let us transition here, right, to talk about the history of mermaid mythology. And we're going to start with the earliest known versions of merpeople. The ancient Babylonians worshipped A, or Enki, who was the god of ritual purification. He was known as a wise but very tricky god, very susceptible to mischief.
Like your cat.
Like my cat. He was known again as the god of ritual purification, and these cleansings were called A's water.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah. Some accounts credit him as the form-giving god, the god of artists and craftsmen, farming, building, and of sorcery. He is also the national god of Babylonia and exorcisms.
I feel like that second bit was like when you minor in college.
Major in the national god of Babylonia, minor in exorcisms. In my research, Enki comes up quite often. Some sources identify him as the earliest version of a mer person, and others don't mention mer anything in association with him. Sometimes he's depicted with horns, and other times he has water flowing from his shoulders. And the thought is that all water comes from him. Like, he is the ultimate source of water.
Interesting point here.
Okay.
This is probably the origin of, like, the male, well, of the merman, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of horns is not that uncommon, you know, especially when you look at modern depictions of tritons, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So the point that I wanted to bring up is the horns. Why on earth would horns be on a fish?
Well, there's some, that's a good point, that what I was watching about him, there's some versions where he's almost like a mammal, you know, like a satyr or a stag or something that would have like antlers or horns. And there's other water versions of him.
Got it. So he's also the god of mischief and trickery.
Yes.
So he's also Loki and Satan, which
right.
are always the horned satyr.
Exactly.
Got it. So it's yep. all the same.
Yep. He used to be worshipped as the being that brings the substance we need, right? Water to live. He was the source of water.
Mm.
Some depictions, and this is a little graphic, show that the Tigris and Euphrates rivers were actually made up of his semen.
I mean, that's okay. Like, the...
It's okay, but I, you know.
Go to Greek myth and how many things were formed from the spilled seed of the severed genitals of Uranus.
There you go. I don't even know. So, right, there's all these different versions of Enki. But I stumbled upon a website called Mermaids of Earth, which broke down some of this for me. So, A, or Enki, was also called Oannes by the Greeks, and Dagon by some Semitic tribes, was a man with the body of both a human and a fish. So he was not, quote-unquote, a mermaid. He was sort of a...
Well, the just a fish person.
Right, like he could transform.
Right, so also Dagon is a big character in Lovecraft mythology.
Oh, interesting.
So you have... Oh, Lovecraft absolutely loved sea people. They're like, oh, Tritons are also from Lovecraft. I'm trying to remember the name of the story, but there's this whole thing where these fish people keep, and they're like, it's like reverse mermaids, where it's like arms and legs of a human and then body of a fish.
That's funny.
So like picture, yeah, it's like a
do they have
SpongeBob
human heads?
Fish. No, they got fish heads.
I see.
But they have arms and legs of humans.
Yeah.
Well, sort of. You know, they just got the red appendages.
Sure.
And, you know, they have their whole underwater city and society because they have their underwater sea god of Dagon.
Right.
And they're just basically hunting on land to feed the god.
Right. I like that better almost because, I mean, listen, I love the visual depiction of a mermaid, but I also really appreciate because it is so enduring any other versions of, like, human sea hybrids, which we're going to get into a few that are outside the normal physicality.
Well, at least mermaids from a anatomical perspective make a bit more sense.
Yeah.
You look at Lovecraft's sea people and it's like, okay, let's take a fish and remove all the things that they use to swim.
Yeah, that's true. So Ea and Enki weren't the only versions of early aquatic gods. The indigenous people of Australia believed in yok-yoks, life-giving spirits that lived in water holes. They were depicted as women with fish tails. There are also water spirits and other related to mermaid-type creatures from ancient times, including water nymphs and sprites. More as subcategories of creatures versus named deities or gods. For example, the Greeks had an entire system for classifying different types of water nymphs, depending on the type of water they lived in. The first appearance of a mermaid as we know them today is from the Mesopotamian kingdom of Assyria around 1000 BCE.
1000 BCE, you say?
I say.
Well, my research contradicts that strongly.
Okay, let's hear it.
This is one of my two mermaid facts.
Okay. This is second of two?
Yes, the first one being Christopher Columbus falling in love with manatees, despite how ugly they were.
Mm-hmm.
According to my own research... The first mermaid depiction comes not from 1000, but 2500 BCE.
Okay.
From this wooden carving of the Syrian goddess Atargatis.
Okay, so that's who we're talking about. So maybe I just have my dates kerfuffled.
I mean, there's a chance that, I mean, that could have been the first written.
Right.
You yeah. know, mm-hmm. instance. This is just a stone, this is just a wooden carving.
Yeah, I think you might be onto something that maybe... My account is like the first written account, but then obviously there's evidence of the belief in this spanning for long, long time before that.
And honestly, it doesn't matter, and we really don't care.
No, we do. Like, honestly, having something from 2500 BCE that we're talking about in 2021.
There are still trees that are from before then.
No way.
Yeah, there's 5,000-year-old whispering white pines.
Where do we find them?
Well, you don't. That's the point. Most of the ones that are still in existence, their location is a huge, huge secret.
Oh, my God. Really? This is fascinating.
Because every time there's something super cool and it becomes public knowledge, some fuck-up just takes a chainsaw to it.
Well, they have to be protected in some way then, no?
Yeah, but I mean,
they can't just be protected by secrecy, because then someone could accidentally just like deforest them, as we do as an awful race of people.
Well, again, all these things are, I'm making some assumptions here, but I'm assuming all of these are on protected land.
Right.
So you're not worried about just like accidental deforestation.
Okay, great.
However, you're absolutely going to have to worry about the equivalent of like tree poaching.
Right.
You know? So first
get
off,
one of those things on eBay.
Well, one of the, it's so upsetting. Like you can, all of these, all the forests with like 1,000+ year old trees, like even just like in the Amazon, right? All of those trees are so, so sought after because ancient wood has like a very unique aesthetic property to it. And people love building furniture and very high-end design pieces out of it.
Right.
But like you're using something that took literally millennia to create because you want a fucking chair.
No, it's terrible. It's to me, that's
Abby,
so...
Abby, you need to stop buying Whispering Pine furniture.
To me, it's so incredible that there's a living thing on Earth that is so old that I totally understand that we need to protect them and the threats to that. But I just love that. I can't believe it. That's so cool. They must be so huge.
I'm sorry. It wasn't Whispering Pine. That is not a thing. It is Bristlecone Pine.
Bristlecone Pine.
Yep. And well over 5,000 years old is the charted oldest one.
Very cool. Does it give you a region or anything like that?
Yeah, according to this one article, they're saying they can be found in California, Utah, and Nevada.
Okay, road trip. Let's go.
I thought they were not in the U.S. That's interesting. I just know that they usually grow at like crazy high elevations.
Right.
And it's a very, very slow growth.
Gotcha.
Obviously, it's like the... I don't know if this is true or not, but it's just the saying that everything has the same amount of, it's definitely not true, but the saying that everything has the same amount of heartbeats.
Right.
So you can have the turtle, which just beats really slow and lives for, you know, 200 years.
Yeah.
Or you have the hummingbird that, you know, beats 10 trillion times a second and lasts for like 14 seconds.
Wow. That's very poetic.
Yeah. It's also probably not true.
It's not true, but I love that. There is some allegory there.
Or you have the jellyfish, which probably doesn't even have blood in a heart, so that's why it's immortal.
Right, right.
That's not why it's immortal.
No.
But it is immortal.
Why?
Really?
Jellyfish?
Jellyfish, yes.
Is immortal?
Yes.
What does that mean?
They don't age. Sorry, they do age. They go through
Okay, so what you're saying is wrong.
Well, excuse me. They don't die of old age. They live to a certain... They go through the cycle of life, and when their cells get to a certain stage... where normally just death would occur, they instead split into the equivalent of newborn cells, and it just begins again. So basically, they just, as soon as they get to a certain age, they just revert and just start aging again.
Have they evolved, out-evolved all of us?
What? What does that mean?
Like, at some point, should we do that too?
That is actually a huge aspect of scientific research, is trying to pinpoint what about the jellyfish, and same with lobsters, of what exactly makes it so they don't age.
You know, it's illegal now to boil lobsters alive.
It is.
You gotta knife them first.
You do, and you always should have, which is insanely cruel, because it does no change to the meat.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But the whole thing with lobsters, so they too don't traditionally age, but unlike jellyfish, because they have the exoskeleton, they have to go through molting. Eventually, the inside if left to their own devices, which is why you can have lobsters that live for hundreds of years and they're, you know, absolutely enormous.
Yeah.
Eventually, the inside grows a little bit too fast to keep up with the outside. Mm-hmm. And it basically suffocates with inside its own exoskeleton.
Oh, poor guy.
Yeah. Oh, poor guy.
Circling back to the earliest known appearance of a mermaid. So goddess Atagirtis.
Also, I don't know if that is how you pronounce it.
Okay.
The Atagirtis is the name of a fictional ship, which is why I've always pronounced it that way.
I think you're probably into something.
It just rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. So Atagirtis was the chief goddess of northern Syria in classic antiquity. She was also called Derketo by the ancient Greeks and Dea Syria by the Romans. She was mainly worshipped as the goddess of fertility. The story goes that she fell in love with a shepherd who drowned in a lake. Her agony was too strong to go on, so she tried to drown herself in the lake so that she may be reunited with her true love after death. However, the gods did not let her die and instead transformed her into a fish woman with a humanistic upper half so as not to hide her beauty.
The one amendment that I want to make, which is just a bit more poetic, in the rendition of the story I read, she threw herself off a cliff mm-hmm. into the sea, and on her way down, they changed her into the likeness of a mermaid so that she would just slip into the water and live in the sea.
I like that. Yeah, there's also another version, which I talked about at the beginning of the episode, where it wasn't because the loss of a lover, it was because of an unplanned pregnancy. So I think there's lots of different versions of it.
Mm.
Though she is not always described, though, as the mermaid goddess, sometimes she is only associated with the water ocean in connection with fertility, right? Because like we talked about at the beginning, water is life-giving. 1001 Nights is a collection of Middle Eastern folktales that was compiled in Arabic during the Islamic Golden Age. It features many stories of merfolk and people who can breathe underwater, called sea people or seaborn. This collection is commonly referred to in English as the Arabian Nights, which was what the first English version was titled, and that came out in the early 1700s. So I think you're going to especially like this section.
Okay.
Sirens of Greek mythology.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we knew this was coming.
We knew. Many people believe that sirens are a precursor for mermaids in mythology.
That makes sense.
The saying goes that no man had ever heard the siren song and lived to tell the tale. Originally, sirens were the handmaidens to the goddess Persephone. Because Persephone was kidnapped by Hades, her mother Demeter gave her handmaidens wings so that they could search for her. So sirens were actually originally bird women. During the Hellenistic period, they changed into women with a fish tail. Their song was originally a function of perpetually calling out to Persephone in the hopes that she would hear them and return home.
Aww. In true form, whatever is like just nice and friendly for the gods is like fatal for humans.
Yeah. Sirens appear in two epic Greek poems, the Odyssey and the Argonautica. And the Argonautica was actually the name of the boat in the Kraken movie, Deep Rising, that we...
Aha! Yes. That's where it comes from.
And you can listen to our Horror Movie Club coverage of that on Patreon.
Mm.
So these poems depict sirens as feminine creatures that lure sailors to their deaths, very much like mermaids. Both poems use different defenses against the sirens. From filling their ears with beeswax in the Odyssey to drowning out the song with their own song in the Argonautica.
Well, not just drowning out with song. So in the Argonautica, so you're on the Argo, right? Voyage of Jason to find the Golden Fleece.
Mm-hmm.
They have Orpheus with them, who is just supposed to be the world's greatest musician. And so he just starts, you know, strumming. And his music is just so mind-blowingly awesome that it competes with the mystical lure of the sirens.
It's like that Tenacious D song.
It is. It's just like the Tenacious D song. But the one thing that I never... Oh, actually, I was about to say, the one thing I never understood was... So during the Odyssey, when, you know, Odysseus and friends are sailing past the sirens, everyone puts... beeswax and cotton in their ears.
Mm-hmm.
But Odysseus...
We should say that Odysseus is out looking. He's so intrigued by the siren's call that he wants to hear it.
Well, so I was going to say, like, why did he... because they just tied him to a mast.
Yeah, they tie him to the mast because he wants to hear it, but they want to make sure he can't be lured away.
Right. And actually, as soon as they set it out, it all clicked. He was kind of like the caged canary.
Yeah.
So, you know, they needed somebody to be able to hear because they needed to know when the song was done.
Right.
Because if someone's like, hey, is it done? Takes out their little, you know, earplug.
Right.
And it wasn't. They're going over the ship.
Mm-hmm. Overboard.
Man, yeah, and then never to be seen again because they're going to eat them.
Yeah. Also in Greek mythology, we have the Nereids or the Naiads. So there's a Greek creation myth that says the union of Oceanus, which was a river that encased the entire world, and Tethys, which was the ocean, produced 3,000 daughters and tasked them with guarding the deep.
Right, so, which is interesting because in their mind, 3,000 was the exact number of bodies of water on the planet.
Right. And Nereids were similar creatures that were believed to protect fresh bodies of water. So in a lot of actually the research that I did on mermaids, they're classified as like a heraldic animal, which means that they're tasked with protecting the oceans in some ways.
Yeah, it's just guardian forest spirits, but bodies of water.
Yeah.
Every body of water had one, which was kind of cool.
Yeah.
So one of the most famous Nereids was actually Thetis. Only because, so she, you know, she is just a river deity.
Yeah.
Should be of no large acclaim. However, she had a very famous son named Achilles.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right. In the Song of Achilles, we fear her.
Oh, I mean, in the book Song of Achilles?
Yeah, that we read.
Yeah. She's all over. She's the main character.
I forgot about that. She's so scary.
Well, it's interesting. So she was supposed to be the most beautiful creature in creation, which obviously would make her quite the target for the lusty gods.
Right.
Right? But she wasn't, because there was a prophecy. And the prophecy said that her child would be greater than the father. So obviously all the gods are like, well, fuck that. You know? Well, and that's kind of fair. Every other instance of a child surpassing the father in Greek mythology leads to like a downfall of a regime.
Right.
Like Kronos taking out Uranus, Zeus taking out Kronos, you know? So they all just said hands off. But then a mortal comes by and he's like, wow, she's pretty. And they're like, there's a prophecy. It's like, oh, that I'm going to have a dope son? Fuck yeah. So they have a son and it's Achilles.
Right.
And the interesting tie to this episode is that Achilles becomes the leader of a specific band of fighters known as the Myrmidons,
mm-hmm.
which has no affiliation with mermaids, but it sounds similar.
Yes. And you've been wanting to work it into this episode for
absolutely.
Some time.
Absolutely.
And now you have. Hats off to you.
Well, Myrmidon is actually... Well, it's spelled with a Y instead of an ER.
Right.
But it is also synonymous with like robot warrior.
Mm, interesting.
It is.
Yeah.
Irrelevant, but interesting.
So now we're going to talk about Triton.
Okay.
Triton, who you may recognize both from Greek mythology and as Ariel's father in Disney's The Little Mermaid, is arguably one of the most famous mermen there is. It's interesting that neither of his parents, Poseidon and Amphitrite, are described as merpeople, though they are described as being able to live on both land and sea. But somehow they got together and were able to produce a half-fish offspring. Triton appears to the Argonauts to help them on their journey. Sometimes the word Triton is used interchangeably with merman.
Interesting. So Triton was a son of Poseidon and Amphitrite.
Right. And neither of them were merpeople. They could live on land and sea, they could breathe underwater, but they were humanoid, and somehow they made a fish human baby.
Yes, humanoid, but all of them were, you know, all the gods were shapeshifters. They could all turn into all sorts of animals and do all sorts of things.
Right.
You know, the amount of times that Zeus turns into an eagle and does nefarious things, it's no different than when Poseidon turns into dolphins to do stuff.
As we often discuss when tracing myths and legends back to their earliest roots, many of them stem from the Middle East, India, and Africa. It is impossible to holistically understand mermaid culture without looking at the early origins of humanity and thought. According to Alexander Skye from the book, mermaids have existed within African mythology for millennia. Mami Wada is one of the most influential of those. Mami meaning truth and wisdom, Wada meaning water or ocean, or in some languages, women. Mami Wada is actually a pantheon of African water deities.
Wait, so this one deity is her own pantheon?
So early versions show human heads and torsos with fish or snake tails. They are mostly feminine, but can also be masculine. And as time passed, they evolved to represent a single deity, usually a woman with a large snake wrapped around her, but they started as a whole pantheon. And if you want to make an offering to her, as I believe you should, she particularly likes mirrors, jewelry, and combs.
Hmm. She sounds a lot like Ran from Norse mythology.
Mm.
So Ran was a deity of the ocean who in Norse mythology.
Yeah.
And she loved collecting things. She had she was famous for having her giant net and would basically make these giant whirlpools.
Mm-hmm.
That would just suck everything down, you know, to the dismay of sailors and whatnot. But whirlpools obviously collected debris and stuff. And so when there was just like hordes of stuff under the ocean or like washed up on shore, it's like one of her nets broke.
Interesting. So she's to blame for all the pollution in the oceans.
For collecting it, at least. Well, she also would get mad when like bad shit got thrown into her ocean.
Sure.
You know? Actually, also, we're kind of projecting modern philosophies on ancient cultures.
Right.
You know, I don't think they really worried too much about ocean pollution back then.
Well, yeah, because they weren't awful.
Right. And, you know, they didn't really have, you know,
the means
plastic
of production, right, the way that we do.
It's like, how dare you throw your old wooden canoe in the ocean?
We also have Yamaya, sometimes also known as Yamora or Ye Amo Asia, translates to mother whose children are fish. She is the focus of several African religions, and as you might have guessed, a goddess of the ocean. She originated in the Ogun River, which is the biggest and most important river in Nigeria. When Africans were enslaved and forced to travel to the United States, many believe that she went with them and watched over them. She is often depicted as a mermaid, and over time she evolved to rule over the ocean, not only the river. Interestingly, she represents the upper parts of the ocean, most close to the surface, which were believed to house the most sea life and the nourishment that people needed to draw from, right? So she wasn't thought of as like the protector of the whole ocean,
mm-hmm.
but of the shorelines and the things that really nourished the people.
Yeah, that people care about.
Right.
Who cares about, you know, middle of the Atlantic?
Right.
Not these people.
You may see a theme here, but she also represents sexuality and fertility.
Oh my.
Yamaya has a daughter, Ocean. Ocean rules over fresh water. Like her mother, she's also depicted as a mermaid, sometimes holding a gold fan.
Ocean spelled O-S-H-U-N.
Correct. She is a bit vain, but interesting that she is also a fairly positive water goddess. Most of the other African water goddesses are seen as temperamental, just like the ocean itself.
Interesting. So there was a benevolent water god.
Yes.
Goddess, excuse me.
Right.
Which is pretty uncommon. I'm trying to think, like, I'm thinking of other mythologies and just everybody is temperamental.
Yeah, because it makes sense, because when you rely so much on the water and the water is unreliable when there's storms and all of these things,
mm-hmm.
you understand the parallels there.
Right.
The personification of the ocean.
Right. How would you have something that's benevolent that's also constantly changing?
Right. Okay, so transitioning over to early Asian water gods and water creatures.
It's like we're sailing around the world.
That's right. Broadly, water. What's the name of the boat from 2,000 Leagues Under the Sea?
The Nautilus?
It's like we're on the Nautilus exploring.
Well, that was a submarine. That wasn't a boat.
I know, but I'm saying we're on the boat. We're on the submarine.
That's true.
We're diving down. Okay, so broadly, water creatures and deities from Asia are thought to bring good luck and fortune.
The creature is called the Broadly?
No, I'm just saying in general.
Oh, gotcha. Sorry, I misunderstood.
There is also much connection between the water deities in Asia and the dragon. Many have alliances with the almighty dragon.
Hell yeah.
So let's start with Benten the Beautiful.
Oh.
Benten originated in India as Sarawati, a Hindu water goddess of arts and knowledge. The belief in her traveled to Japan, where she was renamed and reskinned when Buddhism also traveled to Japan in the 6th century.
What was her new name?
So Benten the Beautiful was her new name. The original name was Sarawati.
Interesting. So Benten is a Japanese name.
Correct.
Hmm. Didn't see that coming.
Bento box.
Got it.
I don't know.
Box of the sea.
I don't know if that's right.
That's canon. There's always seaweed in there.
And fish.
That's right.
She had the very cool job of overseeing the geishas. She eventually evolved again, and by the 16th century, she had become the goddess of prosperity for the upper class. Benton loves to dramatically ride dragons and sea serpents onto the scene.
See, that makes sense that you'd have a benevolent sea god, mm-hmm. right? That loves dragons.
Yeah.
Because in Asia, dragons are always benevolent.
Mm-hmm.
Not about always, but traditionally. They're super lucky.
Yeah.
Grand wishes.
Right.
Hashtag Dragon Ball.
She also loves to play the lute, and she is a shapeshifter. She also has more hands than usual, sometimes up to 8.
That's a lot of hands.
And it's also believed that she originally came to Earth in order to stop evil dragons from eating kids.
Yes!
Many scholars point out the similarities between Benton, Venus, and Aphrodite.
What? No! In what way is this cool, dragon-riding, benevolent sea god with 8 hands and plays the lute similar to Aphrodite?
Aphrodite, born of sea foam.
Sure.
Loves to ride around on a clamshell.
Does she?
She did it once.
In that painting.
Well, that's how she came to shore from the ocean.
Yeah, okay. She did come from sea foam. Mm-hmm. I'll give you that. She just, I don't know. I'm on Team Benton here.
I mean, yeah, I am too. In Japanese folklore, there's a creature called Ninyo, meaning human fish. These are not the sexy half-human, half-fish that we have in other mythologies.
Like those sexy Dagon SpongeBob fish people.
That's right. Ninyo have a very specific and unique physical look. So picture this. Huge fish, 35 foot long, with only a humanish head. So we have 90% fish, human head.
That's silly.
So they also have a red stomach, eyes around their torso, and golden eyes. Unlike other versions of a mermaid, the Ninyo cannot speak.
So it's just a weird looking fish.
It's a fish with it's a huge fish with a human head with eyes all over the body.
Okay, it's terrifying.
There's a folk story that goes like this. An old Japanese fisherman caught something curious at sea. It looked to be a fish with the head of a person. That didn't stop him from capturing it, cooking it, and trying to serve it to his guests, who, of course, were not into it and refused to eat it because they felt like something was off.
I mean, it's got a human head. It's fucked up.
Except for one man who had drunk too much sake. He took it home, fed it to his daughter, who immediately stopped aging and lived over 800 years looking fresh as a daisy.
Holy cow.
Yep, if only he had known.
I did not expect the moral of the story to be like, no, eat the fucked up fish.
No, eat the fucked up fish.
You'd think like, mythical beasts, by not eating you, we're going to grant you wishes or some bullshit.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you should always eat the mythical beast.
So back into the sub.
Okay, where are we going?
Slavic and Russian folklore.
Huh. Oh, I guess, I mean, there's a lot of coastline there. Just you picture a lot of these things as landlocked countries.
Oh, there's sea everywhere, my friend. So in Slavic folklore, as well as Russian and Ukrainian legend, we are introduced to the Rusalka. Rusalka are terrifying female fish spirits who are known to lure young men to them and kill them using their voices, so similar to a siren.
Oh, here we go again. Appropriation.
The legend is that these spirits are from women who died because of an unhappy marriage, meaning either their husband or lover killed them, or they successfully completed suicide in order to escape the abuse of their partner. So very dark. Sometimes the drowning was related to hiding unwanted pregnancies by the father, right? So like they drowned the woman in order to get rid of the child.
That seems a bit extreme.
Yes. But it happened. Similar to Atagartis, they are also associated with fertility. Some iterations reveal the Rusalka emerging from the water once a year and walking over the crop fields in order to fertilize the seeds. After the 19th century, they transformed into more evil, dark spirits.
You know what word I just learned?
What?
I mean, this is not an uncommon word. Mm-hmm. I just not heard it before. So you're familiar with benefactor.
Yeah.
Do you know the antithesis of benefactor? Malefactor. I just love, like, just you don't hear about too many malefactors these days. Although there's plenty in the world.
Plenty. So they use their beauty and vocals to ensnare men and their hair to strangle them. Though in Poland, the Rusalka were known to tickle men to death. They also can physically morph to become more alluring based on the preference of their victims from far away. But when the unsuspecting come too close, they see the horror of the Rasalka's true image, moldy and green.
Ew.
It's like in The Shining.
It is?
You know that scene where Jack Nicholson's looking at the woman in the bathtub and she's like all hot and naked and beautiful, and then suddenly she's like a decomposing corpse demon?
Oh. I was like, I don't remember there being mermaids.
That's literally exactly how this would play out. That's what a Rasalka would do to you, but like in the fields.
Got it.
If their death is avenged, they will escape this horror show after life and kind of be free, right, of this burden of being an evil spirit.
Got it.
Similar to Medusa, they symbolize extreme beauty, but also receive respect and fear, for they are very powerful and dangerous, and she loves to dance.
She loves to dance?
She loves to dance.
How do you know that?
That's what all of the books said.
Just as a little footnote every time.
Rasalka loves to dance.
But that's sad because they don't get dancing partners.
Well, they can, but then they just kill them.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. All right, so we're back in our underwater submarine.
Wait, what?
We're speeding towards the United Kingdom.
Oh, right. I forgot that's the thing that we're doing to travel around.
It's like in movies where you travel around the map. You know, like travel, you show the airplane.
Yeah, I've seen the Muppets movie.
Right, and in like Indiana Jones.
Yeah, it's the fastest way to travel.
It's the fastest way. So here we are. We arrive in Western Europe. It was considered a bad omen to come across a mermaid at sea. A curse of the voyage, so to speak.
Why?
Because women are wicked.
Oh, right. No women on the vessel.
That's right.
Because that's bad luck.
Bad luck. They very often foretold stormy weather or shipwreck. That's what they associated mermaids with. Like, if you see a mermaid in the ocean, a storm's brewing. It's like pink skies at night, sailors delight. Pink skies in morning, sailors take warning.
Or the fact that you're hallucinating is probably also a pretty big red flag that the voyage is going downhill.
Sure. Okay. So outside of ocean mermaids, the United Kingdom also has folklore around merpeople within rivers and lakes, which are also seen as dangerous. It was believed that if you came too close, they would drown you. Some alternate stories show mermaids saving sailors or others who were near drowning, or actually taking the time to teach them natural remedies and medicines from the deep. Selkies, who we talked about in the Celtic Fae episode, are creatures of Irish, Scottish, and Icelandic descent. Seals that can also transform into humans. So in human form, they're often beautiful women, but, you know, they turn into seals. Selch means seal in the speech from Scotland's Orkney Islands. We often see Selkies in the form of romantic tragedies. So
when did we talk about Selkies?
In the Celtic Fae episode.
That's why.
Yeah. So generally, if a man comes across a seal skin shed by a Selkie in human form, he can take it, which forces her to become his wife.
Hell yeah.
No, that's terrible. We don't want to force women to be wives.
Free seal skin.
Okay. She can steal it back in order to escape, which leaves her husband lonely and desolate.
Yeah, he has no wife, no seal skin. He's got nothing going for him.
Another version is that if a lonely fisherman's wife cries 7 tears into the sea, a handsome male Selkie will come and make love to her.
Oh, hell yeah.
Hell yeah. Everybody wins.
I guess it's tough to cry 7 tears specifically.
It is.
That's a lot of tear control.
It is a lot of tear control. It'd be easy to cry more.
Can you cheat with like Visine?
All you have to do is put on an episode of The Office.
That one episode.
Oh, there's multiple episodes.
There's also that episode of Futurama with the dog.
I have not seen that.
What? Well, for all you listeners out there, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay, we're now going to take a hop and end up in France. Melusine is a French word for a European spirit. Typically, she appears similar to a mermaid as a human on top with the lower half of a fish or serpent. Some iterations give her wings or multiple tails or fins. Here is a little quote from Wikipedia. One tale says Melusine herself was the daughter of the fairy Priscine and King Alinus of Albany, which is now Scotland. Melusine's mother leaves her husband, taking her daughters to the Isle of Avalon after he breaks an oath never to look in at her and her daughter in their bath. The same pattern appears in stories where Melusine marries a nobleman only after he makes an oath to give her privacy in her bath. Each time, she leaves the nobleman after he breaks the oath. shape-shifting, and flight on wings away from oath-breaking husbands also figure in stories about Melusine. One of the most well-known stories about Melusine dates back to the mid-1300s in France. So they all sort of follow this same pattern. And again, she's not like a god or goddess, but she is this spirit, or it's almost like a local folklore, you know, like a local legend.
Yeah, it seems on par with the naiads.
Yes, exactly.
It's just a mythical beast of divine origin, but not among the gods themselves. Or just like a lesser deity.
So it's somewhat similar to the Rasalka, right? Where they're born of bad male behavior, you know? Also, I didn't realize this, but there is actually a biblical reference to mermaids.
What?
According to Sky Alexander, again, who wrote the mermaid book, the story of Noah's Ark references merfolk. A 15th century biblical illustration of the story includes a merman, a mermaid, and merdog swimming along the ark. So to be fair, I don't know. Let me defend my position.
Merdog?
A merdog, yes.
What is a merdog?
A merdog.
What does it look like?
Top dog, bottom fish.
Does it doggy paddle?
Yeah.
Why?
And to be fair, I don't know if this was a biblical reference or if this wasn't a biblical painting.
No, it's canon.
But either way, it's kind of a funny iteration of Noah's Ark.
I just Googled merdog. There's lots of corgis.
They're very buoyant.
Mermaids. Well, their butts float.
Yeah.
This is weird. Oh, we're getting to some weird furry stuff. I got to stop Googling this.
Okay. So the final thing we're going to talk about today.
Okay.
Not a specific place on the map. We're going to travel to a center of being here.
The Selkie?
We're going to talk about twin or split tail mermaids. Dating back to antiquity, we see images and art of mermaids with dual or split tails.
Because of a recessive gene.
You may remember, or you can Google, the original Starbucks logo for a visual of this. Because the original Starbucks logo actually had a split tail mermaid.
Huh.
Where she kind of had a tail going off in each direction, which is how they had like the circular...
Oh yeah, it went back. That makes sense.
Like a U, yeah. According to the author of the book, this mermaid is a combination of an early Celtic fertility goddess named Sheila na Gig. And so she is known to squat in order to show off her genitals. And she is also a mermaid as we mostly picture them today.
Power play.
The obvious connotation is that the twin tail allows for her to have sex with human men.
Aha. That's where it is.
If you're looking to encounter art featuring this lass in the wild.
Who's not?
You can visit many, many, many European churches. So 5 or 6 major French churches, not to mention Notre Dame. And a handful of historical Italian and English churches still feature this like medieval or earlier art of the church. Let's think about this. We're in a church, a cathedral, this split tail, lusty mermaid art. So you may be thinking like I was, Alan, why would images of a sexy mermaid be painted all across these major churches in Europe?
That's very obvious.
Mermaids were used.
Thirsty men.
No. Mermaids were used to symbolize certain sins to churchgoers. In this instance, the sins of vanity and lust. These paintings were meant to inspire churchgoers to avoid temptation, though it probably just gave them something fun to fantasize about instead of paying attention in church.
We are hundreds of years away from thinking it's even acceptable to swim with exposed ankles.
Oh, no.
You know? So, like, of course, a lusty sea woman is going to be the epitome of sin.
Hell yeah. She's the epitome of everything.
Everything?
Yeah. She is all.
Piety?
She is all. No, I just think she's cool. I mean, obviously, she's developed out of, like, hate, but I love the power of her now.
While she squats and presents her genitals?
That's right.
It's like, oh, just walking by the coast. There she is, squatting.
Which is also, like, such a male gaze thing, right?
Well, I think it's like, wow, we have this image of a mermaid, but I really want to have sex with it.
But I can't. Where's the hole?
Exactly. What do I do?
Give her 2 tails.
Well, I'm glad you asked.
Ugh.
Thirsty man.
It's gross. Anyway, so here we go, Alan. Do you know where we are?
Are we taking the sub?
The sub?
Yeah.
No, we're right where we're meant to be. We are in the pop culture section of this episode.
Okay.
We have to start, of course, with The Little Mermaid.
Ah, the biggest phony of them all.
It's the pinnacle mermaid story, right?
I don't know.
In all of its forms.
There is not a single instance of murderous mermaids in anywhere in The Little Mermaid.
That's not true.
Well, in the Disney version, there's not.
Do you consider Ursula a mermaid? Because she's pretty murderous.
She's a sea witch.
Yeah.
She has tentacles.
I know. She scared me so much when I was little.
Did
and
she
the
really?
Eels. I hate eels.
Well, we're going to get into mermaids and eels and their ties.
Wait, are we?
Oh, yeah.
When?
In the pop culture section.
Okay. So it is perhaps the pinnacle mermaid story in all of its forms, from the original fairy tale by Hans Christian Andersen to the Disney blockbuster, which at the time was one of the most successful box office films Disney had ever released. Andersen's The Little Mermaid was first published on April 7th, 1837 in Denmark. There is still a statue in Copenhagen that 75% of visiting tourists see while they're in town of the mermaid.
What? How the hell did they get this statistic?
Listen, I got all the facts.
They poll 100% of tourists. It's like,
what
did
you see?
Yeah. Did you see the Little Mermaid statue?
75%
Three
said
out of
yes.
four say yes.
The Disney film was released in 1989, and it is very loosely based on the original story by Andersen. It was originally planned to be one of Walt Disney's earliest films, part of a package of vignettes from Hans Christian Andersen tales in the 1930s. However, the project was delayed and put on ice until 1985, when there was renewed interest at Disney. So can you imagine? 1930, we could have had a mermaid.
And it would have been not nearly as good.
No. I mean, it could have been funky and retro, though.
Well, so what? With the first one was Snow White, right?
I don't know. The first one was Steamboat Willie.
Right, but I'm saying like the first big color...
Fairy tale?
Well, yeah, big color Disney extravaganza movie, I think, was Snow White, because that was 53, 54?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, it's one of the very early ones. And Snow White, there's certainly nothing wrong with it. It does not nearly have the finesse of The Little Mermaid.
Yeah, fair enough. So, of course, we have Peter Pan, which for me growing up was important with mermaids because I loved the mermaids in Peter Pan.
There's little mermaids?
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember that.
When they're in the cove, of course there's mermaids. There's like Tiger Lily is taken and they go by and there's all the mermaids. And so in Hook and Pan, there's also mermaids.
Huh. Yeah, I don't remember. I read the book. And I don't remember mermaids.
Interesting. Maybe they were just added in the movies.
Maybe. I mean, it's also, I glanced over it. That whole world is full of so many, you know, fantastic beasts and where they're found that I just don't think that they're not a pinnacle part of the story. It's more of just like a detail.
Well,
right?
Yeah, but I don't know. For me, I think this is me projecting because for me, they were pinnacle.
Well, you
saw
the movie,
them.
Right?
Well, I loved mermaids so much that anything they were in, I was like, I love this. They're so cool. I loved the way, you know, I don't know if it's outdated or not now, but I just remember being like really excited about them.
I mean, that's fair. I feel like a lot of girls from our generation really strongly resonate with mermaids.
Absolutely.
Do you think it's simply from The Little Mermaid and Ariel and all of the branding behind that, or is there more to it?
I think that's certainly a big part of it. And I think that it's almost like this, you know, it's like, I think because of those things, it became a really fun and accessible escapism, like fantasy game. You know, like there's this stupid TikTok of a guy and he's like pretending to be, you know, like a little girl and her friend. And she's like, in the pool today, I want to be the mermaid with the brown and, you know, white tail. And she's like, no, I want to be the mermaid, you know, and like, it's,
oh, I've seen this.
I didn't do that as a kid, but I resonate with that make believe. And I think that, yeah, it's easy to be like, oh my God, they're so beautiful. They're so cool. They're in the water. They're like, they're just really powerful and magical. And I think a lot of girls attached to that,
which is interesting because did they have magic?
Well, they're magic in that they're magical creatures.
In that they're defying laws of physics of breathing and talking underwater. And
yeah. And they have their own magical worlds. And, you know, reality, living in the ocean is like probably pretty bleak.
I'd say more mystical than magical.
Okay. If you want to split hairs here.
Sure. Well, I'm just trying to, because like in those movies, so I'm trying to think of like in like the Disney versions, mermaids have what abilities? They could...
They swim underwater. Their existence is magic.
Okay. Because, like, Ursula, who's not a mermaid, but...
No, but nobody wants to be Ursula. She's terrifying.
But she has all these powers.
Yeah, but that's not... I'm not in it for the powers.
Does Triton have powers, or does he have the Triton?
With his Triton.
Trident that...
His trident has power.
That zaps.
Right.
Okay.
Like Zeus.
Yes.
Yeah. So... There's a few non-horror films to call out here, right? For live action, we have Splash, Aquamarine, The 13th Year, and of course, Aquaman.
What is 13th Year?
It was like one of those old, I don't know if it was Disney or Nickelodeon or whatever, but it was like, you know, you turn 13 mermaids.
What?
You know?
No.
I don't want to give it away.
Okay. Okay. So we won't talk about that one. I'm not familiar. I would like to talk about Aquaman for a moment.
Yes, as I figured you would.
So this was always a very, I was always a little baffled by the Aquaman mythos. So in Atlantis, Aquaman's stomping grounds.
Sure.
Splashing grounds, whatever. There's traditionally two caliber of folk. Like one is like, they look just like humans. But they can, for some reason, breathe underwater.
Yeah.
And basically fly underwater as well. Because they don't swim. They just, like, propel themselves at crazy speed. Like Superman, but underwater.
Sure.
But then there's also the whole race of merfolk who look like fish people. They look like Creature from the Black Lagoon. And there's a whole race of them down there. And those are, like, the true Atlanteans.
Right.
And it...
The fishmen that washed up on the Indonesian shore.
And I'm sure it's addressed in the comic somewhere. I'm just not super versed in Aquaman. But like, when did that happen? Why are there just like two races? Like one is like perfectly human with no fish attributes and one is hardcore fish. And why is there no in between? Are there like race wars? I don't know. But like, I feel like that's such a interesting mythos. Like, can the fish people... swim as fast as the people that just fly underwater?
I don't know.
These are things I think about at night.
These are things that never cross my mind. But I know what to get you for the holidays now. Or for your birthday, which is even sooner. So don't buy yourself Aquaman comics, okay?
Okay.
Don't do it.
Well, because... So, in modern superheroes, right? Because Aquaman's been around for a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's still very much around... in like Young Justice, which is a fucking great series.
Well, there's that Aquaman movie that came out.
Yeah, there's the Aquaman movie that answers none of my questions.
Yeah, it wasn't very good.
But I liked it.
I feel like you didn't like it.
I thought it was fun. Yeah, we shouldn't get too much into the politics of Amber Heard.
Never.
She's just awful. In the series Young Justice, so you have Aqualad, who is not Aquaman's son.
Okay.
Despite the naming, he's actually Black Manta's son. Oh my goodness, that's a huge spoiler. I'm sorry. Actually, so he's not Aquaman's son, but he's affiliated. And then you also have Lagan, who is from the fish monster race, which is not the right term. But, you know, he's basically like a fish guy, but he can hulk out like a pufferfish. But when he gets all big, he gets really strong.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just kind of cool. I like him.
Yeah, that's neat.
And he ends up dating Miss Martian.
There you go.
It's cute.
Love is all around us. You just have to open your eyes and look for it.
Or just cry in the ocean 7 times.
Well, that's not love. That's lust. There's a difference. Okay. So let's talk about the overwhelming list of horror movies that include mermaids. We have The Mermaid's Curse.
Mm-hmm.
We have Blue My Mind, The Color Blue.
Okay.
Dagon. Mermaid Down. Mermaid from 2018. Night Tide from 1961, which I would really like to watch. We have Lady in the Water, which is an M. Night Shyamalan film with Bryce Dallas Howard, which I remember at the time being kind of confused by, but now, or I don't know, not confused by, but I had some deep thoughts about it and I would love to revisit. And then, of course, we have the two big ones, the two modern ones. Not that Lady in the Water isn't modern, but two more modern ones, which is The Lighthouse. Do you remember the mermaid scene in The Lighthouse?
I do. It was very graphic.
Very graphic.
A lot of... She did not have split tails.
No.
Despite that fact, there was lots of lovemaking.
Yes. And same goes for the lore from 20, 15, which also included external genitals. So The Lure, which is a Polish horror musical, you can watch it on Amazon Prime. We do a huge deep dive into this on Patreon and Horror Movie Club, where we talk about a Kraken horror movie and a mermaid horror movie for this month's Horror Movie Club on Patreon. But we will talk about it a little bit here because it is worth talking about. It's incredibly dark, and I will say there's a little bit of a trigger warning for me on some of the sexuality in it. But it's incredibly dark, but I think it's super successful at, like, it being, you hear the words mermaid horror musical. I think it pulls it off really well for the most part.
It certainly does. I do also want to quantify that there's a second trigger warning, at least for me.
Yes.
Because there is a live vivisection scene.
Yes. Yes. And I would say watch with caution. The girls look kind of young to me, and it's not great when it comes to the sexuality of it for them, but
it goes into some interesting territory.
Yes.
That said, if you look at the film as a whole, it's very strong.
It follows Hans Christian Andersen mermaid roles, which we think is really cool.
For the most part.
It's graphic and violent, which we've talked about, but it's also got really cool music, and it genre bends so successfully, like jumping between really scary horror moments and very like silly, quirky disco punk music scenes and things like that. And it really is interesting. And even though it's Polish language, and so you don't really always know like what the lyrics are or if the subtitles are one-to-one or whatever, it's very, I think, successful at evoking through the visuals of it. It's very well done. The moods and the transformation that's happening in the characters.
So definitely check it out. And also then check out our Patreon episode as we jump into it.
Yeah. For as little as $1 a month, you can help support the show, which we are very, very thankful for. And you get some bonus content and all kinds of other perks. So check us out on Patreon.
So I think that wraps up our movies.
It does.
Can we take this opportunity to talk about mermaid books?
Please. Yes.
What's your favorite?
The Little Mermaid.
By Hans Christian Andersen?
I don't know that I have a favorite mermaid book.
Well, I certainly do.
Let's hear it.
Which is Into the Drowning Deep by Myra Grant.
Okay, tell us.
The one book I read in preparation for this episode. I just really love the mermaid lore in this, because they did a lot to add. It's one of those things where they add just enough scientific fact mixed in, where the only real leap that they're taking is the fact that in this world, mermaids actually exist.
Got it.
So in this novel, mermaids, their physiology, they look like women on their top half, but only from a long distance. They're humanoid, you know, in that they have a torso and arms and a head. Mm-hmm. Right. But, you know, they don't have breasts or anything. They have a slight convex on their chest, which from a huge distance when you're a lonely sailor might be breasts. But their hands, their arms are like way longer than normal.
Mm-hmm.
Their fingers are like Slenderman long.
Ugh.
You know?
Yeah.
And they're webbed.
Yeah.
And they have a ton of knuckles.
Honestly, that's the most unrealistic part of all mermaid lore, is that of course they would have webbed hands.
Yes. But yeah, they have like a ton of knuckles on their hands. It's just like, they're basically like tentacle fingers.
Right.
You know, but boned.
Ooh, interesting.
But what I love is the tail. It's not your typical porpoise tail.
Mm-hmm.
It's a stupidly long eel tail.
Ugh. I hate eels with a passion.
With a bit of a fin at the end.
I cannot.
But that makes so much sense. Yeah. You know, it would allow for like crazy fast swimming speeds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you know, especially eels and depths and swimming through rocks and stuff makes way more sense than a dolphin tail, right?
Right.
Also, they don't have hair per se. They again have more like tentacles, which was the...
Like Medusa?
Sort of like Medusa. They're thick rope-like things. But what was the lore where the mermaids were able to grab people with their hair?
Oh yeah, the Rasalkas.
Yeah, so it's kind of like that. But the coolest part is that their hair, you know, whatever you want to call it, is bioluminescent.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
So it's all about luring prey. Mm-hmm. Their eyes are enormous because they live at the bottom of the Marianas Trench and have to be able to see with a tiny bit of bioluminescence that they produce. Then they're basically like anglerfish, where they just put out a tiny bit of light and anything that gets near enough, they snap up.
Yep. So they're vegetarian or they're pescatarians?
Yeah. I think they're omnivores. They'll eat literally anything with caloric intake. And so this is what I was talking about earlier, where they're they're stupidly thin.
Right.
Like way more slender than like a human would be.
Mm-hmm.
But that's for, you know, what's the word for aerodynamics underwater? Hydrodynamics.
Where they're trying to fit through spaces and move really fast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Also, like, they just need a crazy high caloric intake.
Right.
Just to maintain their apex predators.
Their energy levels. Yeah.
And, you know, because they live so deep in the ocean, they have no contact with humanity. However, there are, you know, and in real life, there's known areas of the ocean where for some reason fish don't swim.
Right.
And to this day, it's unexplained why fish don't go to these parts.
Haunted.
Or rather, you know, they do, but like, you know, whale migration patterns actively avoid certain areas of the ocean.
Fascinating.
And it's inexplicable. I mean, it is. It's just we don't know because we
don't know much about the ocean.
Exactly. We don't know about it.
Yeah.
In this world, they explain it by, you know, there's a pod of sperm whales that the oceanographers are tracking. And all of a sudden, there's like the hydrophones that are tracking like the whale calls and everything. They just hear horrific whale noises for a while and then they go dark and they don't hear them for, I think, 8 months.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the same hydrophones pick up an exact replica of those whale noises at the bottom of the Marianas Trench.
Yeah. My dad plays us tapes of that all the time.
Well, but that's the kicker. Like, this is an exact recording one-to-one of those whales.
They didn't add a note?
Not a note, not a single change. And, like, that means it wasn't reproduced. It wasn't whales. It couldn't have been.
Right.
Because even if you're singing the same song, you're going to make some slight variations because it's you reproducing something, right? This has to do with like the way that these mermaids hunt is by mimicry.
Right.
They just put out the call of whatever and it just lures things in.
Lure.
Yeah.
Interesting. It sounds like a cool book.
The book opened, all these things happen within the very early part of the novel.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to give away the ending or anything, but like right in the beginning, it opens on footage of this this ship that is being sent to hunt for mermaids as kind of like a fake documentary, not quite a fake documentary. It's more along the lines of like when History Channel used to hunt for Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, oh, we're going monster hunting.
Yeah.
But they actually found them.
Oh, wow.
And they didn't expect that. And mermaids swarm the deck and just murder everybody.
Cool.
Because again, they're apex predators.
Yeah.
And they have never encountered human civilization. They've encountered humans. They just look at them as like a fish inside a shell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their shell being their boats and submarines.
Right.
And all they have to do is crack them open and get the meat.
Sure. I like that. I mean, it makes sense more so than any of the other versions that they would be apex predators and they would not be human, you know, humanoid and all these other things.
Well, the one thing that I thought was so interesting was, so the whole book is about sending out a second voyage to find out like what happened to the first boat. So, cause all they have is the recording of what happened. Cause they had cameras and everything. Cause a show, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they had the vessel with no people. A lot of people are raising concerns of like, what are we trying to prove? Even if we find them, that there's a sentient race down there of like near human intelligence that, you know, is that going to make us like respect the oceans or something? Well, just take a look at land. We have chimpanzees, a humanoid creature of near human intelligence, and you still say fuck you to your environment.
Right.
Nothing changes. dolphins are arguably very close to human intelligence, if not as smart, depends on who you're asking. Just they think in a different type of way. But again, we have zero regard for their environment in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, this whole Kraken and Mermaid series was a PSA to respect our oceans, which yes. we do genuinely think we should do better at.
I, for one, have personally stopped dumping all crude oil into the ocean.
There's a lot we can all do. I will quote Uncle Asar from Jollyville and say, no one can do everything, but everyone can do something.
Ah, thank you.
Yes. So in conclusion, I suppose, of mermaids here, it is very obvious to trace back some of these myths and deities and other belief systems around water gods and goddesses and local folklore, right? We have, on one hand, we have the symbolism of water, meaning fertility and life and hydration. And, you know, it's a life force that's necessary. And it's very understandable why some of those things around feminine energies and deities have come to be. On the other hand, we have lonely sailors who are out at sea for months or years at a time. And listen, I've had a family member that's out at sea for a long time. Start to crack a little bit, right? Multiple family members. You start to crack a little bit, potentially, when you're all by yourself. But even if you're on a ship with people, and you know what? Maybe you start to think that maybe it starts by you just fantasizing that some of the seals are mermaids, and then maybe it turns into actually hallucinating, right? So I don't know. I'm not defending any colonizers here, but I'm saying, well, we can understand, right, why being out at the sea, almost like being on another planet for so long, you could start to have stories come up, and it kind of reiterates these ancient mythologies and belief systems. They've become perpetuated over the years because of that. And then again with Disney, and then again with this and that, right? So it becomes an ongoing fascination for our different generations.
If The Little Mermaid had never come out,
yeah,
we would respect the oceans to this day.
Stop. Mermaids have nothing to do with our disrespect of the ocean.
I don't know. That's on us. If we were still terrified of the sea?
I think we should be terrified of the sea. We don't know what's down there.
We're not scared enough.
We're not scared enough of anything. We are so awful.
Okay, so we need a very large apex predator.
Godzilla. Godzilla will save us all.
Who is an aquatic predator, technically. Comes from the ocean.
Exactly. I've seen the movies.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you guys so, so much for being here. This was such a fun one for me. I really love mermaids, and we've had so much fun researching this and putting this all together and now presenting it to you. So until next time, stay safe, stay spooky, and we'll see you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening. If you'd like some bonus content, consider supporting us on Patreon to access our patron-exclusive podcast, Horror Movie Club.
Also head to lunaticsproject.com to check out our spooky merch and apparel.
You can find us at Lunatics Project on Twitter and TikTok, and The Lunatics Project on Instagram and YouTube, where you'll find our short horror films, cemetery tours, and so much more.
And please rate and review. A little feedback goes a long way to help us grow and get more content out there.
Our cover art is by Pilar Kep, and musical bumpers are by Michaela Papa and Jordan Moser.